Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today we have three in-studio guests, so it's very unusual. Mark Dowling, 20 years of real estate experience in community development. Mark serves as the chief executive officer for the nonprofit Inland Valleys Association of Realtors, known as IVAR. He's been previously a vice president and partner of Del Oro Properties, a full-service real estate development company focusing on infill housing. And Mark also served for more than 6 years on the County of San Bernardino Planning Commission, twice serving as chairman. And in 2010, he was American Planning Association. Steve Manos joins us. He's majored in business economics at UCLA, then entered the real estate field in 1996. He became broker-owner in 2001, founder of Prima Vista Realtors, CalTrust Mortgage, and Alyssa Escrow, and has served over 1,000 transactions during the course of his career. Steve is currently the elected president of the Inland Valleys Association of Realtors. He also serves as a director for the California Association of Realtors, and in 2011 was director for the National Association of Realtors. And Paul Herrera, government affairs director for IVAR, former reporter covering business in Naples, Florida, and at the Press Enterprise in Riverside, and former communications director at San Bernardino County Economic Development Agency. Gentlemen, we welcome all of you, and I guess there's that statement, may you live in interesting times, and I think real estate has found its way there. Mark, you are involved in real estate on a regular basis?
Not so much on the transaction side anymore.
But you're talking to the agents that are.
Absolutely. IVAR has about 4,000 realtor and real estate professional members. We are the largest association in this region, both Riverside and San Bernardino counties. And yes, part of our job is to obviously stay up on real estate issues and trends in order to help our members.
What's the feedback that you're hearing from agents in the field as far as let's go to inventory, first of all?
You mean lack thereof?
Lack of, yes.
Yeah, it's a challenge. We're seeing inventories now that are about 6 weeks of total inventory that's available right now, and that's not healthy at all. We need at least 3 to 5 months in a healthy market. So that is a challenge for our agents, and I think Steve, as a practicing real estate agent and realtor, can probably talk a little bit more about that, but it's a huge problem that we're facing.
Yeah. The inventory that we do have, what would be the makeup of it? Is it for sale by owners, or is it predominantly short sale?
Mostly short sales. I would say roughly about 75% of our overall inventory is in the short sale market, no longer dominated by the REO markets that we used to see. We are starting to see also a lot of investor resales that we would consider those standard sales.
Yeah.
People that have equity, people have purchased homes on, that were distressed and put some money into them and then decided to go ahead and put them back on the market. So part of the recovery process.
Something interesting has really changed, and you guys are probably aware of it, but maybe not because it's pretty recent development, that there's been very large companies with very large money come into the marketplace with the intention of buying and holding.
Mm-hmm.
And you have maybe half a dozen companies with between $100 million and $1 billion buying things, everything in sight.
Yes, sir.
Mike Novak-Smith is an REO agent, you know, one of the biggest in the country. He had a recent listing where it had 94 offers the first day, and the winning bidder was one of these companies.
That's right.
Outbidding every occupant owner and every other real estate investor. So price doesn't seem to be a big deal with just getting inventory. Now that is new.
Mm-hmm.
That's a new development. So if you're an occupant buyer trying to buy in this marketplace in anything that's targeted by those companies or other investors, I would have to think it would be a challenge to get into escrow.
The word that we're putting on the street and every new homeowner that I work with is whatever you think that the market was 6 months to a year ago, it's not that way anymore. And you need to adjust your thinking. There's very, very little inventory. And quite frankly, I think most people come in and they hear what I say, but they need to see it for themselves. And then after the first month or the second month of looking and seeing what's available for market and seeing how fast that it is no longer available, how quickly they go under contract, they become believers, and then they get aggressive. And then they start talking about either pulling back on what they're looking for, or expanding what they're willing to go ahead and spend to get what they want. And that's what I've been seeing as a trend over the past, I would say, 3 to 6 months, I'd say.
Okay. So the number of sales historically is fairly high right now. Is that an accurate statement?
Last number I saw, it's up 20% year over year in most of the submarkets of this region.
Okay, we're up around 570,000 annual sales. That's a lot of sales.
Yes.
I don't think we never were over 500,000 until something like 99. So this is a strong sales year, but it's really hard to get a good sales year to continue if you don't have anything to sell. I would be frustrated if I was a realtor, I got to tell you. You know, I mean, I'm a buyer that supplies my own inventory. And so we've noticed it on the selling side is that something changed about, you know, 60, 90 days ago where all of a sudden everybody got interested in our stuff. And one of the challenges we have, and you can address this, is the appraisal issue.
Yes, sir.
Because all of a sudden, if you have a good product and it's priced pretty well, it's going to get aggressively offered on, and yet maybe the evidence isn't there to support an appraisal. And so, you know, one of the things that we have done, because we're confident, and one of the tenets of appraising is the idea of substitution. So you'll buy a property for a certain price, and if it can easily be substituted by another one, then you won't pay more than that. Well, what if you can't substitute it?
That's right.
Then all of a sudden you have an escalating market. So I guess in prices, do we have an escalating market at this point?
The numbers seem to indicate that right now. I believe the numbers year over year for our region were up,
About 6%.
6%? Okay.
It's the hardest thing to deal with when you're dealing with median price, because that could be skewed inventory. Mm-hmm. You know, there could be Facebook, you know, IPO that makes a bunch of people rich and they go buy lots of houses up there. Or not, depending, I guess, when you bought the stock. But what about across the panel or the let's say, price ranges? Are the upper price ranges still dormant, or are they starting to react okay as well?
I recently had a listing that was for a little over $700,000, and we had probably a dozen people visit it in 5 days and had an offer on it in a week. It was a short sale. It happened to be a short sale. Bank came back and said, well, no, the house is worth more. And they wanted a higher price on it. We relisted it again at a higher price. And again, in about a week, we had a bona fide offer at the bank's asking price. So, I don't think there's as many problems. I think that market's tighter, obviously, and it depends on the region and the area. But based on that example, I'd say there's a lot more money out there than people think, I think.
Well, now there's huge amounts of money. There was we weren't really realizing what was going on until the same people were bidding on everything in sight when you're buying a trustee sale. And they're buying it at 100% of value.
Yeah.
So you know they can't have the same business model as you do. So they're just going to keep these as rentals. Now, I want you to think about ramifications. That's what's interesting about things that are going on, unintended consequences. Somebody's about to buy, have a goal of spending $100 million to $1 billion in Southern California and setting that inventory on the sidelines as rentals.
Mm-hmm.
We've never had that before. Because that one buyer could make a decision to sell and impact the market all by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's never happened before. So the unintended consequences to me is, I'm thinking as a risk, you know, you used to be in development. How'd you like to have a development? And you think, okay, well, I kind of need to know what their game plan is, because you wouldn't want to get into the way of them unloading 10,000 houses. So I bet there's less of a penchant to take a risk in the future. For developers, I think they're going to look at all this inventory and go, we really have to know when that's going to show up.
Hmm.
And so that's kind of a game changer. What about the lenders? How easy is it to get a loan these days?
I can take that one, too. it is extremely difficult. You know, funny thing is it's tighter than it was before, but it's not impossible. There's a lot of dotting of the I's and crossing of the T's, as opposed to what we used to have about 5 or 6 years ago, where you could be a little bit looser with applications, and if there was a mistake, you could fix it later on down the line. Now, the process is very rigid as far as disclosures, as far as what you're disclosing on your application, as far as being truthful and upfront about everything, and not omitting information, especially. I think there's a specific eye towards making sure that there are no mistakes on the origination end, which is good. It's not a bad thing. And truthfully, the qualifying standards for most people is at a healthy level. And I think there's a lot of people out there who might think that they don't qualify when they actually do.
Well, I mean, affordability is off the charts. Capable of qualifying is probably at its lowest because you have all the people that are either upside down that can't buy something or that haven't made a payment in a while.
Yes.
So it's one of those interesting markets where the payment's less than rent, but a lot of people can't afford it. How long are lenders forcing people that lost a home in foreclosure to wait to qualify?
4 years for FHA, 7 years for conforming.
No, I think correctly. It's less than that.
Yeah,
it's
three, yeah. I hope. For
It's three for FHA and two for conforming at this point.
Well, you know what's interesting?
Two for conforming.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting about that, seven is just going to stay on your credit.
Correct.
But the actual market. And the reason I brought this up is that's an overlay. All of these things we see are overlays from lenders, but not FHA's policy.
Okay.
I actually had FHA interviewed. And so, and because I wanted to ask that question, how long before you'll consider loaning to somebody that had a bankruptcy or foreclosure? You know what their answer was directly? 6 months. So
they can, but the banks aren't.
That's right. That's what an overlay is. In other words, if they could stop the overlay, you'd have a completely different real estate market. But the overlays are because they're afraid they'll have to buy the paper back. Okay. What kind of an impact at this point are REOs making in the marketplace? Is it negative?
No.
It's not. There's not enough of them to impact.
I wish there was more. I wish there was more REOs on the market because the problem with dealing with so many short sales is that you're dealing with two negotiation processes. One is with the seller who really doesn't care what they sell the house for, and then the other one is with the bank. And so quite often you have a listing that's out there on a short sale that's listed for either over or under value. It's not marketed. Usually not valued very well. And then the secondary real number comes from the bank 3-6 months later, you know, sometimes. Whereas with an REO, you have one negotiation. You deal with the asset manager, and you get a real yes or no right away. Plus, you can close within 30 and 45 days. You know,
any of this new legislation going to fix the short sale process?
That remains to be seen, Bruce, to be honest with you.
I heard rumors they're supposed to respond in a certain time frame now.
They are supposed to respond, but that doesn't mean that they're going to respond with a specific answer. It just says they have to respond.
Right, and if you don't know all the information, you can get a response. It'll be no.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
I don't know. Sometimes when you look at legislation, you go, okay, I'm not sure I really thought this one out because I don't know how many manpower hours the lenders have been surprised by. In other words, when we look at this legislation and the stacks of stuff they get to do now, you look at that and go, well, somebody's eating this money because that's a lot of contacts, right? And one person now in charge of that file. I wonder how many files they have. We actually had a guy in a boot camp where he was one of those guys. He had 1,000 files. 1,000 files for one guy. Worked for B of A. So how much attentiveness can you possibly do? You know, that's a tough thing. To me, when I look at the bills that are in place as far as trying to help protect the homeowner in foreclosure, and I'm in the business, I'm sometimes even lost as to what somebody's supposed to, what are their rights? What is the process that has to be followed, et cetera? So let's talk about some of that legislation that's in place, and also are there changes that have just really come down the pike to change the game even more? So anybody want to respond to that, be my guest.
Sure. We're talking about the Homeowner's Bill of Rights.
Now, the Homeowner's Bill of Rights has been around for a while, right? Or is this a...
Well, this is a package of legislation that Kamala Harris, the Attorney General, put together in a sense. A number of legislators introduced parts of it, and the Attorney General packaged it as this one series of bills. And they mostly dealt with making it more difficult for banks to foreclose.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a number of paperwork requirements that were introduced. Now, this is all proposed legislation, so none of it actually exists at this point.
But something exists, though, now, because it's harder to foreclose than it was before. So what legislation's in place right now? Is there some type of statute that got passed to where now the lender has to call the people and they have to get mailed and all that. So that's already in place.
There's some new contact procedures that are part of this, but there hasn't been a real overhaul of the foreclosure process. Some of it is related to judicial opinions, the issues with the bank settlement that force new requirements in order to basically stay out of court, you know, next week or next month.
Okay.
But the new package of legislation, the Homeowners Bill of Rights, that's what would seek to systematically change how this process works. And when we started analyzing it, when CAR, the California Association of Realtors, analyzed it, what they realized very quickly is that the legislation does more to create new legal options, basically new lawsuits in the system, than it does to protect anyone's, in quotation marks, homeownership interests. You know, it comes down to whether simple errors or simple omissions or a lost document is the end of the chase for a foreclosure process. And whether simply, if people who make payments don't lose control of their homes, it doesn't happen. But there's more to an answer to the foreclosure crisis, as it's been described, than to simply create new lawsuits in the system that stop that pipeline from moving forward. Foreclosure is a way in which lenders are able to access the security on the loan that they made.
It's perfectly legal process.
Perfectly
right?
Legal. It's the way it was created. You know, California is a non-recourse state. When you purchase a home and you get a bank loan for it, you and the bank own that property. And if you're unable to fulfill your obligations, the bank can get control of the property, the asset, but they can't come after you and chase you down for that part that you couldn't pay.
Which is, by the way, not true in every other state. So this
exactly.
is actually a pretty generous state as far as if you're not going to make that payment, you have very, very few repercussions after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And in New York, that's not true. Mm-hmm. They
right.
can chase you around for a while.
Right. Those kinds of laws, that non-recourse format that we have in California, opens up lending, protects the consumer, and protects everyone's interests.
Right.
The alternative, if we make it into more of a confrontational process, which the banks have to fight for that asset, we turn it into judicial foreclosure. We turn it into a fight all the way through, and the options change. And at some point, it may not make sense if you make it extraordinarily difficult for the banks to access that security. Then at some point, we move to to a recourse loan. And now we're responsible for it all the way through.
Or a non-loan. I mean, that's the unintended consequence. Some lender's going to look at this mess and go, why would we do that? I mean, why would we ever do that with a risk of a 3% down payment? Maybe we need a 40% down payment if we're going to take that ride ever again. You know, that's what I can see some of the people who are well-intended not having enough experience to realize that no lender will want to participate if that's the journey, if someone, stops making a payment.
Or they can bake the risk into a rate add-on to California loans, which has happened in the past also. You can see higher interest rates on loans out here in California
sure.
than you would, say, another state.
Absolutely. Foreclosure alternatives, what are the common ones that the legislation wants to be available?
The legislation, when they say foreclosure alternatives, they mean principal write-down.
Yeah, that's going for principal write-down.
Which is specifically what is extraordinarily difficult, and FHFA does not allow on any of its loans. That's it's not an option that really sits out there and works because someone's got to pay for it. You know, every single option that is proposed, there's a cost borne somewhere in the system to some group. And we look at these proposals and say, well, if you create this new cost, it's got to be paid for somewhere. If not right now, it's baked into the cost next time around,
mm-hmm.
next week or next month, or every system cost is spread out. That's why we have interest rates. That's why we have fees, and we're just going to make it more difficult and more costly to access simple home loans.
There's a quote in some of the documentation that I was given. Nothing in the act shall be interpreted to require a particular result of that process. To where, in other words, I feel like we're just going through the motions. But if you're really trying to get a principal reduction, it was never going to happen in the first place. So could we just state that up front and save a lot of time? The answer is no. We have to go through the journey to get to the answer we would have given you in the first day.
There's a lot of people with great intentions, and that's, everyone seems to be focused on, vocalizing just how wonderful their intentions are. We all want to help homeowners. We've talked about this in a number of pieces of legislation, the importance of helping consumers. We all want to do that, but the question is, how do you do it in such a way that you don't do long-term damage to a system that has helped homeowners and helped people achieve ownership for generations?
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I mean, you look at the track record of prices being stable. It was perfect until 2006, and mm-hmm. that was when we had some of those very generous loan programs where you could state things that weren't true and that was acceptable to everybody because no one cared. Outside of that, we've done a good job. So going back to before then would be good. We're trying to go way beyond that to something that's unnecessary, and that's the hard part. You know, the other thing is we're not differentiating sometimes between the types of person that's in foreclosure. And I'm sure the smallest percentage of the pile is somebody that signed something that they didn't know what they were signing. Mm-hmm. That's the small pile. A pretty big pile would be I bought a house for California for $100,000 and I refied my way to $500,000. Mm-hmm. Can somebody help me, please?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why? Mm-hmm. You just got $400,000 for nothing. That seems like that's a good deal.
Right.
But they're getting treated exactly as Group A, and I don't get that non-differentiation.
Some of these programs, you talk about the cash-out refinancings. If you create a system in which you're able to do that, and essentially come away free and clear with both your property and the money you access at the back end, you create a brand new set of perverse incentives that says nobody should ever have equity in their home. If you have a chance to pull out money, pull it out.
Or no one should ever have access to the equity. In other words, the other side will say, well, since Texas. That happened to us, well, somebody way up in Carr actually said that on this radio show, that they think there should be legislation preventing the access of equity. And that's from Carr. So, you know, that's to me, I just think, okay, I don't want that to ever happen. I want there to be risk associated with that opportunity. You know, that's a great opportunity. Most of investors I know, a lot of their success came from accessing piles of equity and playing Monopoly, and it can go wrong. And that's the other part, which you just mentioned, I think is really important. There's nothing wrong with feeling pain about something that you did that wasn't right in business.
That's right.
That's how you learn. So if you lied on a loan app and you did a stated income and you really couldn't make the payment and it came out bad, if we don't let that actually have an end result that's not positive, where you can own a house for 3 years and you're going to remember that, we won't have this problem again. But if we write everybody a check and say, hey, it's all even, it's all okay, wow, what's next?
I tell a lot of people who I'm listing their short sale just about that. There is life after foreclosure.
Absolutely.
Is life after short sale. You'll feel better. You're going to be able to work easier. There is a burden that's lifted off of you by doing that. And, you know, and I think taking some personal responsibility for the actions over the past few years, it's not a popular thing to talk about.
No.
But
well, I'm on a task force for Riverside foreclosure at the city. So I'm the wild card conservative. And certainly the only investor. And they were talking about things that they could do for the people in foreclosure. And I said, honestly, one of the best things you could do is tell them that the lender has a legal right to chase the asset if they're not getting paid and that is, in fact, life after foreclosure. You will own a property again.
That's right.
That's okay to tell people rather than having classes to say, how can we teach people how to forestall this for as long as possible?
That's right.
And get the biggest cash for key settlement. You just go, wow, it's getting more difficult to want to participate, you know, under the rules. Just another minute and a half for this segment. A couple of changes, single points of contact. And I know that that's been an issue. We buy a trustee sales and we'll show up at the door and say, you know, I'm sorry you lost your home today. Here's how we'll cooperate with Cash for Keys. And they go, what are you talking about? We have a short sale that just got approved. And they're not getting.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's probably a good change, if you will.
We're talking about the I can't remember the name of the bill, but it's moving through right now, sponsored by CAR.
Go ahead.
Right.
278, I think it is.
278, which is once a lender approves a short sale, they can't then go through with the foreclosure, which allows that, you know, there's already been a negotiation, you've got an accepted offer, you've got a process that's ready to go through. And
is that the dual track?
The dual tracking part.
Yes.
I'm sorry. And there's a there's a need. You know, you have a willing seller, willing buyer. You have a deal essentially made, and you're moving through the process. And we don't want to see the consumer or the buyer, the owner or the buyer, have to have the rug pulled out from underneath them.
Right.
And this bill is moving through. We're supporting it, and we hope it gets done into law.
Okay. Yeah, there's some things that it can be reasonably done to help people that are in foreclosure. And as a trustee sale buyer, that's not a pleasant door knock when you get somebody surprised on the other side.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
That's very, you know, that's just, oh, boy.
And it happens very often.
Yeah, because then, you know, it's everything's worse of a hassle. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us on our first segment. And we'll talk about a very interesting concept called government eminent domain on the next one.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.